And then we went from Bombay to you know where. I never forget the look on Rod's face when we came into Karachi. And I suppose if he were giving this report, he'd say, I never forget the look on Lauren's face when we got into Karachi. But there met us at the plane someone to brighten our hearts immediately. And I want to tell you about this man, Bishop Chandu Ray, an Anglican bishop. Now, I used to think that anybody that wore his collar on backwards certainly could not be saved. Well, of course, I've learned different. Besides, I happen to be a Baptist, and I know in Britain, for instance, the Baptist ministers wear their collars on backwards. In fact, I thought of borrowing Chuck Ferris' clerical collar in order to give this report, to give a little atmosphere to it. But I thought I'd better wear my Christmas ties instead. Bishop Chandu Ray is now 45 years of age. He was a Hindu, and his people, parents, were prosperous Hindus. His mother made a pilgrimage of the Hindu sacred spots of India when Chandu was a young man. And he looked forward to this trip with his mother in hopes that there he could find reality. And when the trip was completed, he said to his mother, he said, but I didn't find reality. She said, nor did I. But the Hindu books tell us that we'll be rewarded in the next life for having made this trip and visited these places. Well, he wasn't satisfied with this, and so he began reading about various religions. Well, when he was 27 years of age, a friend of his was taken to the hospital to have an eye removed. And this friend was a Christian, and he asked Chandu went to visit him. And that evening, the young man who was to have his eye removed said to Chandu, would you read the Bible to me? He said, yes, where will I read? Well, wherever you want. And so he just happened to open to John 14. And Chandu began to read to his friend. And when he came down to the verse, where it says in, whatsoever you shall ask in my name, that will I do, that the Father may be glorified in the Son. He stopped. He looked at his friend. He said, did you hear that? Whatsoever you shall ask in my name, that will I do. He said, why don't we ask God to give you your sight and to save your eye? So they knelt down beside the bed and they prayed all night. By morning, through prayer and the word, Chandu received Christ as his Savior. And as the morning came on, he said to his friend, God has given me my spiritual sight. He will give you your physical sight. Well, today this man has both eyes. He's got 20/20 vision. Well, Chandu went on into the Lord's work, and he went off to school. And in a seminary, he got into some higher criticism concerning the Bible. And he began to have doubts as to parts of the Bible. And as he said, and I quoted him here, he said, these doubts sterilized my ministry for the first 9 months. Then a missionary came along and said, Chandu, do you really believe what you preach? He said, well, of course I do. He said, no, wait a minute. Do you really believe in the authority of the entire Word of God, the Bible? And at first it incensed him that anybody would challenge him, but then he began to think, well, really, I do have some doubts about parts of it. And this missionary helped him and led him to believe in the authority of the Word of God. And since then, he has brought others to Christ continually, sometimes day by day, sometimes week by week, the authority of the Word of God. This man went ahead, beginning in 1947, and he's translated the entire Bible into Urdu. And he was telling about his translation work. He said if he got cross or irritated, and he'd sit down to translate some part of the Bible, he would labor over it for 3 hours, and he'd be intellectually all there, but the words just wouldn't come. that just wouldn't form. And then he'd get on his knees, ask God to show him the trouble, he'd confess, and then the translation would open up. And as he said to me, you know, the Holy Spirit is very easily grieved. Well, this man is a go-getter. Through him I learned something about the situation in Pakistan. It's 36 million people. 90% of them do not read or write. It is a Mohammedan or a Muslim country. And as you know, Mohammedan countries are probably as difficult as any in the world. However, as he told me, there is a great moving of the Spirit of God in Pakistan. He said in one province, for instance, they are so open, they seemingly prepared, that you can almost literally say that 80,000 people are waiting just to be saved for someone to get in there. Well, this Anglican bishop, with the exception of the United Presbyterian Church, which is the largest mission in Pakistan, and who has, as I remember, 62% of the work in Pakistan. We say Pakistan, they say Pakistan. He is the man who's been responsible for getting evangelical missions into this country. And there is a wonderful fellowship among the missions. Wonderful. And he said to me, the navigators are welcome to Pakistan and we need what you have. When can your man come? Of course, the other thing they wanted to know was when can Billy Graham come to Karachi? Well, we went up from Karachi, which is down here, flew up to Lahore. That's where the main missionary work is being done, particularly by the United Presbyterians. In Lahore, which is another place you don't ever get stuck if you can help it, we looked all around to get a bus to go up to the town of Gujranwala, where our meetings were to be held a few hours later. As we went to bus station after bus station, fortunately, all the buses were crowded. After I saw the buses, I was delighted. And, I mean, the dogs, the people, the everything on there. It's quite something, and then you never know if they're going to make it or not. Very common all throughout the area. You see the buses stalled, the people standing around, the drivers out and under repairing it, and cars that are stalled and all the rest. I remember one day driving down Vietnam, down the road, we saw a man having trouble with his car all right. The engine had completely fallen out on the road. So we got up to Gujranwala. In fact, as we took a taxi the 50 miles, it only cost us $9, so that wasn't so bad, especially when I had meetings starting at noon, lasting to 10 o'clock that night. So I told Fred Stock, who was our host, I said, well, we've come this far. We won't quibble over $9, but let's make our appointment. Fred was an old-time navigator. He's a new-time missionary out in Pakistan, and he has a wonderful rapport, was the confidence of all the missionaries. He's the one that set this up for us. And missionaries came in from all around here, and I started right after lunch, talked for an hour and a half, then we had tea, talked another hour and a half, and then after supper they wanted more and we talked another hour and a half. I tell you, hungry? Well, we could spend a long time there, I'm sure. And they too, when can a navigator come? When can a navigator come? A lady missionary was talking about the difficulties of Pakistan. She said, I hate to go to the market. She said, these Muslim men will stop and stare at you from the top of your head till the foot, till the soles of your feet. And she said, I just feel soiled. She said, I wish that I could wear a veil like some of the Mohammedan women. She said, I don't blame them. Just to be protected from the stares of evil men. That's just one of the problems of working in a country like that. The food, 90% of the people can't read or write. And I'll confess to you that I have done more thinking and searching in my own heart about Pakistan than any other one place. And on this basis. So, do you intend to ask somebody to go to Pakistan? Are you willing to go yourself? How about if it was you? And I don't know who the Lord has in mind, but if he uses me to ask him, I can assure them that this old boy has done some careful thought and prayer about it before he's ever taken that step. Not that our others don't need prayer, but somehow or other it was impressed upon me the terrific thing would be of asking a couple to go out there. And yet the Lord just undertakes for us. You know Don McCurry and his wife? They had just arrived just before we got there. Don was down in Karachi, and when we were stuck there those 3 extra days and kind of plane problems, we had time with Don every day because he was going through the Oriental red tape and rigmarole of getting things through customs and doing without bribes, which is really a problem because everything is done on that basis. His wife was up here in Lahore, and I saw her. And she said this openly to others, she said, I fought coming to Pakistan till the day we left. But she said, my heart's at perfect ease, and I'm here. I love it. I have perfect peace about my children, about the whole situation. So sometimes we say, well, Lord, I couldn't go there. Just like D.L. Moody, somebody said, do you have dying grace, grace to die? He said, no. Because I'm not dying now. But when the day comes that the Lord will take me, then I'll have grace for that event. Do you have grace for Pakistan? Well, maybe not. But if God called you there, you'd have it. He'd give it to you. Because His grace is sufficient. And I do believe we have a responsibility to Pakistan. And I told the bishop that we let him know about April, about March or April. What we would do. Well, in Lahore, Rod and I got out the airport, all set to catch our flight down to Karachi so we can get out of there and get to India. We're all checked in, sitting there to wait for them to call the flight, and they said it's canceled. Yeah, but we have to get through. Our flight leaves Karachi for Nairobi tonight morning at 1, and there's only one flight a week. Sorry, the weather's bad. Oh, Rod says, they can fly through that. So, all we did, we went back into the hotel and stayed down the next day, and sure enough, Karachi, we'd missed. We thought maybe it might have been delayed from India. It was an Air India line, but no such luck. So there was an East Africa Airlines leaving on Tuesday night. We hoped to leave Monday morning. So we stayed. But Tuesday morning, and just in a routine checkup on something else, we discovered that the Tuesday night flight was postponed 24 hours. I don't know who would have told us if we hadn't been checking up with Pan American on something else, so we got to stay stuck there for 3 days. But it proved to be a wonderful time of preparation in our own hearts and a rest, too. Very nice climate that time of the year. That time of the year. It gets 120 in the summertime. Well, we'll stand up again, and I'll tell you about India or Africa and Europe, and then we'll wind this up. Now we're in Nairobi, East Africa. Rod is about to burst, and he's trying to be calm because he knows there's big game hunting nearby, and he doesn't want anything done to push it. He wants the Lord to open it up. But he's really concerned that it is opened up. So I have a letter and a check waiting for somebody for $60. A lady who's quite a hunter herself said, I'd always hoped to get to Africa. Would you fellows go hunting by proxy for me? Well, I had a little business to do, so I said, Rod, why don't you and Bob use this? So they went out for a couple of days and got an eland, something like a buffalo, only bigger, like an American bison. So they had a great time. In Africa, I certainly seen the results of the prayer, the hard work of Dick Hightower, and the money that he's been able to raise for this vision here. See, the reason we went to Africa is because of the Mau Mau prison camps. I think you know that. And there I learned a lesson right away. How come the navigators were called to Africa? One missionary out there said to me, he said that whenever a mission pours a foundation and puts on it some bricks and mortar, they become awfully immobile. And they can't get to the places where the opportunities are. And there's something I noticed, that the Spirit of God seems to be especially at work in certain places in the world, like Vietnam, for instance. But we're so rooted to a place that we can't adjust quickly to the places where the harvest is to be reaped. And that was one of the problems in Africa. So we were asked to come. That's how come we went there originally. Well, then Doug Sparks went out with Joe Schenkel and Bob Howarth and got that work going with the Mau Mau, the evangelism. And I met people out there. I met the Denders would be interested in this. I went out to a Mau Mau camp, which is the end of the pipeline. That is, at the last stage before they get back in their village. And I watched Rehoboam. As Rehoboam, they invited the students of the course together, and about 40 came. And Rehoboam instructed them. And afterwards, some of them came up to speak to us. And there were about five or six of them that spoke pretty good English. And one of these prisoners came up to me and he said, "How long have you known the Lord Jesus as your Savior?" So I told him, I said, "How long have you?" He said, 2 years. And he told about the twins that played the horns. And he remembers their ministry in the camp. And he said, "When you see them back there, would you give them my greetings?" And I'll have to look up his name here. I don't know as you'd know him, though. But I'm telling you, that fellow was keen and sharp. He knew what was going on in the Lord's work around the world. He somehow or other had been getting hold of Christian periodicals. He'd been reading the Word. And I was all excited. I got to Ed Rice later and said, "Ed, have you met this fellow yet?" He said, "No." I said, "Look, boy, here's a potential Timothy. Let's get hold of this guy. So when he gets out in his village, we've got him. That he could be your man. Or any one of these other fellows. They're just as bright and alert for the Lord as you could imagine." And right there is the big push for Africa for this next year. Ed and Bob hardly knew where to start. Joe Schenkel, with his terrific ability to cover many things at once, and he's in good with everybody. How he did it, I don't know. But the result is that Ed and Bob could be just spread so thin and work themselves to death that a year or 2 years from now, we wouldn't have too much to show for it. For instance, in Kenya, there are European settlers who have farms, estates or farms. The average farm averages about 8,000 acres. They have Africans working for them, living on these farms in little villages of from 500 to 1,000 on a farm. And virtually nothing is being done for them. So the Anglican Church has asked for a loan of Bob Howarth for 2 years to work among these people. I talked with Colonel Grimshaw. Also, he's with the Church Missionary Society from England. He told me about the terrific needs up here in Uganda. He said, "Could you have us a man there by March?" He said, "The whole Anglican Church out here is open to you." The Europeans, to work with them. What are they to do? I said, "Well, Ed," and this is what he wanted anyhow. I could see it, both of them. I said, "Look, what did we come out here for?" The Mau Mau. There were the educated young men. They're the right age. We've had a great investment in them already. You concentrate on one thing, producing some Timothys among these Mau Mau. You tell the Anglican Church that the answer to their request is not no, it's yes. But the time is not yet.
that we came out here to work with the Mau Mau, and if we stick with our job, then 2 years from now, we'll have some keen young Timothys that we can use to help on these estates. But if we don't produce here, we may as well close our mouths as far as the rest of Africa is concerned, because we've got to put up or shut up. We must produce the thing we've preached. And if out of the Mau Mau, some of these keen young fellows, and the setup is perfect, because here, some of the end of the pipeline camps are right outside Nairobi, you could set up a system for interviewing these fellows right there, and find some of your potential Timothys before they even get to the village, so you'll have a line on them already. Then, 2 years from now, we've got some real strong disciples among these young fellows. We won't have to worry about open doors in the rest of Africa. There'll be so many demands, so many requests, we won't know what to do with them. And you know, you've heard it said, and I've heard it said so often, well, the Africans, they can never take over leadership. They just don't have it. We went out to the farm of a Mr. Rodseth, who's a hard-bitten settler. I don't believe he's a Christian. But he's tried everything he could to promote good labor relationships with his Africans on his farm. He told us how he started with improving their working relationship with diet, health, schools, hospitals, playgrounds, and so on, and education. But none of it worked. And then he began to see what Howarth and Shankill were doing with so few Africans on a spiritual basis. And he sees this as a thing that is succeeding. And as a businessman, he's interested in the navigator's work because he thinks it's the answer to his labor problems on his farm. But here are some of the things he said. He says the answer is to make them disciples. He said, your work, the navigators, is the only one that is succeeding because you're making disciples. Now, I'm quoting him, not me. And he said, he told how he brought in a pastor to work on his farm. And here's what he told this pastor, and I think it's terrific advice. He brought in this man to work with his Africans, and he said to him, he said, don't preach at all. Just go around mending homes, helping folks personally. And it's working. He says that the Africans are fascinated with the Bible. Because I was interested to get the viewpoint of a man who was raised there and who just looked on it from the side. He said the Bible will give him peace of heart. He's filled with fears. He says Christianity is the tranquilizer. And here's what he said. The African has the brains, but not the discipline. He won't get the discipline until he gets it through Christianity as a true disciple. And I think he hit the nail right on the head. Don't you, Doug? They've got the brains, don't have the discipline. And they'll get that through Christianity as a true disciple. Well, there are a lot of other notes here. But I talked with Timothy Kamau. Timothy is 36, has 6 children. He is, I could tell you the story of his life, but he's a borrowed Timothy in the spiritual sense. And I learned a good number of things from Timothy. He's an African. And one thing he said was this, as we talked, he said the reason the missionaries say that the Africans can't run things is because the missionaries don't train the African. They don't teach them what they know. Now, I realize this was an African talking, but I think he's right. Something else I learned from Timothy Kamau. He is the African who had written me, said he prayed for me every day. What a dear fellow. And this was a lesson that I had seen in other parts with which I was unfamiliar, and that is that you can't go native. You cannot go out as a missionary and become exactly like the people. In the first place, they don't want you to. In the Orient, I discovered that they lost respect for you. Timothy Kamau told Bob Haworth, he said, in the first place, you couldn't be like the Africans or live like them. He said, the people to whom you would go are still Africans, and no matter how low you brought your living standard, it would be impossible to keep it at that level. And they, in turn, could not live up to yours. You would lose your opportunities with the farmers and the Europeans, and frankly, you couldn't live on an African diet, and an African could not afford even a semi-European diet. And what they like to have you do, as I see it, is something like the English. I found out in England that they didn't want us to try to dress like them and be like them. They wanted us to be subdued Americans. And I think that that is more close to the principle, at least that I've discovered as I've studied this also on this trip. Now, Roy's home is going to be a Japanese style, but he's also going to have a meal a day, this with his family. Newkirk's home is Japanese style, about two-thirds of it. And the American servicemen really love it. The kitchen is Western. Their bedroom is Western. But the matter of how close can you get right in with the African? Well, those are just a few thoughts on that. Oh, one other observation in Africa. Mr. Eric Barnett, head of the AIM for Kenya, said, I see happening with the navigators what I have seen happen with so many other similar organizations. They are getting so bogged down with other things that they are neglecting the main ministry for which they came, the recruiting and the building of men. Well, I thanked him. And I shared it with Ed, and Ed said, thanks, that's good. That's just what we want, a direction. This satisfies our hearts. But there are so many opportunities, so many things overwhelm us, we didn't hardly know just knew where to start. All right, Ed, let's narrow it down to this. Okay, Europe. I skipped the Middle East because I needed to get extra time in Africa, and this wasn't a pleasure trip anyhow. It was to see our people. So Rod went there and took a look at things. It looks like Beirut is certainly our key spot for that area of the world. Went to Paris, France, and had a couple of days with George Clark and Gordy Nordstrom. George is working close with a young American who looks like a Frenchman and whose name sounds French, Boyer, who's doing evangelistic work in France and who's certainly growing and being used of the Lord. These young fellows have stepped out, and they've taken the Velodrome de Vire, or however you pronounce it, in Paris, where Billy had his meetings a few years ago, for evangelistic meetings. They're having their difficulties because they did one thing that's always difficult, namely, they got the evangelist, set the date, rented the place, and then went to the pastors. So you can see they got some problems, but they felt the Lord had led them and all. But I suggested it might be better to let the pastors think it was their idea. But on the other hand, I don't want to leave the boys in a bad light, because oftentimes in Europe, if you waited for the pastors, you never do anything. So it really takes some real prayer. George and Evelyn and their two young'uns will be coming home in about June of this next year, and weeks of this year, 58, isn't it? And we'll be home for staff conference. We went on up to Frankfurt, and there again, as in Paris, I brought the first snowstorm of the year. Having come from the tropics, it was really something to get in the winter. And met with all the gang there for 2 days. They came, Pete, George came up from Naples, and his wife, and The only one that wasn't there was Marge Wilbraham, who was up in Copenhagen taking care of the little Wilbraham offspring. Gay got somebody to take care of hers down at Bitburg. So there we were for 2 days, and I tell you, it was really a joy to be with the gang. And there I afflicted them even worse than I've afflicted you, and I told you all morning, afternoon, and evening on this report, and I didn't have to report to them about them, so... Then we made a real quick trip down to Bitburg to the service center where Gay and Stan are responsible, and they've got some real key contacts there. It's moving rather slow right now, and they need some prayer because, as with most of our people that go overseas, the first year, year and a half is the most difficult until they get sort of adjusted to the situation. And I know this is going to help my own prayer life for our own people, particularly as they get out that first year or year and a half. Homesickness and adapting to the people, and particularly for the wife, because so often there's no ministry with women that speak English, and so the wife is just alone. Nobody with whom to fellowship, talk with. And it gets awfully lonely, just all day, every day, day after day after day. And we need to remember them. Went down to Kaiserslautern, where the fellows have again taken a great big monstrosity of a house and have converted into a very nice service center. Their vision staggers me. I never would have had the vision to do something with a dump like they have done with it. They polished it all up, fixed it up, and they've got a wonderful ministry going. There we have Tommy and Sue Atkins. In Wiesbaden, I stayed at the home of Bill and Sybil Ham. They have a spastic child that they left at home when they went, and I think it's her mother. The baby got ill and was very poorly taken care of in this place, and her mother went and took it out to take care of the child, and then her mother's had a heart attack and some other difficulties, and there's only one thing for them to do is to come home and to help get this family situation settled. So Bill and Sybil will be coming home in March, and I would certainly appreciate prayer for them. Another thing, their relatives feel that they have walked out on her mother, that they've played a dirty trick on her, they've walked out on the family responsibility, and they're going into a very difficult situation when they get home. So I know that they would appreciate prayer. It may be that Bill will go with us, will come out to the San Francisco Crusade, and then we expect Bill and Sybil to be with us during a good part of July, and particularly during staff conference. What a wonderful couple. The Lord's hand is sure on. And of course, old Rod got into Germany to visit some of his ex-secretaries, three of them there, Carolyn Peterson, Irene Kemmes, and now Laura Hopkins. Carolyn, bless her heart, she's just as hardworking as ever. She hasn't been too well, you read the majority of the time. And she's carried a heavy load there as a secretary. She and Irene have an apartment together, and just the details of keeping that up and the buying of the food and the cooking and all has been difficult. They're having times, they're meeting with girls, having a wonderful ministry. But as a result of our time there, we decided that 3 years should be a maximum for a single girl on the field. And we've made arrangements then for Carolyn to come home about November 1st of this year. So it'll be good to see Carolyn, just like always. And Irene Kemmes, always a good, even-tempered attitude, as you can well imagine, and just blends in beautifully there with the Germans and being greatly used of the Lord also. Mel Leder is responsible for the service center in Wiesbaden. He's got a big job on his hands, but he's growing in it. And, of course, Laura and Bob Hopkins. They're just sort of an aura or a glow that's around Bob and Laura constantly. If I've ever seen anybody in love, a couple newlyweds, there they are. And so I spent one evening in the night in their home. So Laura's cooking is very, very good. They have a nice, lovely apartment. And the Lord has been very gracious to them. We went into Berlin and saw Peter and Margit Schneider. Peter's our representative there. And that was quite an experience in Berlin. We had a good time of fellowship with Peter and with Margit. And among other things, on Sunday afternoon, we got on a U.S. Army sightseeing bus and went into East Berlin for a while, about an hour and a half. Peter didn't particularly care to go. He hasn't been over there because his name is rather well known. It's been on the Bible study courses and all. And so he didn't care to get involved. Just about 3 days before we arrived, the East German government had a new ruling that any East German going to West Germany, I would be in prison for 3 years, regardless of the purpose for which they're going. They're trying to seal off the East from the West absolutely. And I think you've heard East Berlin described. West Berlin, beautiful, lovely new buildings, cars, well-dressed people. East Berlin, well-populated, but the streets practically empty. And there's one main street, Stalin Alley. Beautiful, or medium beautiful. And you just look through some of the arches or down some of the alleyways, and right behind it, both sides, still rubble. What a contrast. And we got out, and a few places. We weren't supposed to take pictures of Russian soldiers, although our guide said that if you were taking a picture of a building and they happened to walk in front of you, you couldn't help it. So Dan, with the aid of his Minox camera, was able to get a few shots along the way. But Peter is, we feel that, we think that Peter is going to be going to seminary for about the next 3 years. Be a very necessary thing for him, really, in Germany. And what's more, it would put him right in the midst of a school of young men, the only school that to which East German students can come to school and go back to East Germany. So it would be a wonderful opportunity. I met some of the people that worked in the two girls that helped him in the correspondence school. He was telling me about the work with some of those who are in the school that are doing the work behind the Iron Curtain. And we spent quite a bit of time discussing what we can do to protect these people. Our staff in Europe, except for Berlin, are typing up or have typed up the names and addresses of all their people on their files, sending them to us here, so in case of a war or an emergency, they could immediately destroy those files, and then afterwards we would still have the names and addresses. Because the communists have only one interpretation on anything you do, and that is it's political. For instance, there are two, I think it is, inter-varsity representative Germans who are now in prison in East Germany. And they had gone around visiting some of their students. And unfortunately, they had with them an address book of about 150 names. Well, that to the East German government and officials can mean only one thing. That they are, with other organizations, establishing contact with these people for the day when they'll just pass the word out to all of them. Now is the day for the uprising. So everything is politically interpreted. So you have to be real careful. Had time with Pastor Brower. What a man of God he is. And from him I learned something else about Germany. The Germans have one consuming passion. At almost any cost, with whom they'd have to compromise, it's one thing. That is reunification of Germany. That's the burning, consuming passion. Something else I learned from Pastor Brower, who really knows, that in West Germany, he feels that Christianity is watered down and weak in the main, but in East Germany, it's virile and strong. Persecuted, yes, but much stronger in East Germany than in West. Not numerically. Well, we went up to Copenhagen, and saw the Wilbrahams. And a cute little guy they've got, too. I forget his name, though. What is it?
Stephen,
that's right. Yes, he even had him out at the airport to meet us. But I tell you one thing, up there this time of the year, the sun doesn't get in your eyes because it just goes about that far across the horizon. It's dark by 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Already, in just a little while, the Lord has supplied a wonderful apartment for the Wilbrahams and some real keen contact with some of these Danish people. And I believe that we're going to see something strong through Bob Wilbraham in Denmark through some real keen Timothys. Well, then we went on up to Stockholm, and were met by the Swedes. And they could only talk about one thing, and that was the Glen, and the warm hospitality they had here, and how it revolutionized their lives. One man's going to quit his business and go into training men, and the Swedish team, they're going to leave off this, it's going to be training men, and so on. I could see the results of some propagandizing on the Swedes when they were here. And the guys were really alert and sharp. I had a wonderful time with them. The only trouble was Dan and I got sick that day and had quite high temperatures, but that didn't seem to bother the Swedes any. We went right ahead with the entire program. And you can leave it to Paul Lilienberg. He had ways and means eked out whereby we could stay longer and cut ourselves shorter somewhere else. He said, well, for instance, in Oslo, he said, you just have contacts, say you don't have a work, but we've got business to discuss. I like that. He was just right on the stick there to see to it that we got some time. A little interesting thing along the way, how the Lord has continued to answer prayer. To travel this part of Europe this time of year by air is pretty difficult. And to keep a schedule where you're 2 days Berlin, 1 day Copenhagen, 1 day Stockholm, 1 day Oslo, 3 days London, and then to get home. Got into Berlin, couldn't see the other end of the runway when we landed, snowstorm. We thought we might have spent Christmas in Berlin. Next day the sun shone, kept shining for the next 3-4 days, all the way up to Copenhagen, up here to Stockholm. Well, we came in through the soup there, but we got in. The fellows live in Orbro, but right over here. And then we're going to go to Oslo. Well, we had plane tickets from Stockholm to Oslo. So we were going to be driven back to Stockholm and get the plane for Oslo. It'd be on my round-the-world trip ticket. So, but Dan thought we might take a train. He said, well, you decide. So we were met by the fellow. I said, no, let's take a train. I'd like to see Sweden. So instead of going back, we got on the train from Orbro to Oslo. We'd been on the train a little bit, and we talked with a man who'd gotten on that same train that morning in Stockholm. All planes had been canceled out of Stockholm. We got to Oslo and found that it had been fogged in for 3 days, nothing taking off or landing. Well, I could see us spending Christmas in Oslo. Boy, I don't know. This is kind of hard on me, Doug, to set a arrival date, 23rd of December. So we got to Oslo, and the night before we were to leave, the next morning it cleared up. So we went down to the hotel desk, pay our bill. We're going to call a taxi to take us to the air terminal for the bus. And a man walked up to us at the desk, and he said, would you men like a taxi? Well, yes, we expected to call a taxi. Well, he said, I have been trying for a long time this morning to get a taxi, and there's only one operating in all of Oslo. And I had to call the police to get that one. And I was getting it for an elderly lady to get her to the train station. In the meantime, the police offered to take her, and so they took her. Now I've got this taxi coming, and nobody to use it. Could you use it? Just then the man walked in. We had our bill paid. We got out and walked into the only cab in town that was operating that morning and went down to the air terminal, got our bus out the station, and flew on down to London. Just another little thing along the way, and I could tell you a lot of them, how the Lord just takes care. A friend of ours used to say, coincidence? Well, who makes the incidences co? That's the Lord. We got into London, and just about every year at Christmas time, I began to lose my voice, and I did this year. So I had to cancel most everything in London and rest my voice for a meeting that the General Haffenden had arranged in All Souls Church, John Stott's church, in London. And we had, I guess, about 500 people that came out, and what a blessed time it was. Mostly counselors and some converts from Haringey and from Wembley. Then we saw Dave Steele, of course. I didn't get to talk with him. I wasn't supposed to, but Dan spent a good time with him. And Dave, with his clerical collar and all, looked like a real Anglican clergyman, and bright and radiant for the Lord. We had time with quite a few people. And let me see, I thought there was something here. No, this says personal, confidential. And Rod and Dan were there to spend the last couple of days so we could have some last-minute business. And we hopped aboard a plane and came by way of Detroit. And to my amazement, I got off the plane in Chicago. I was thinking, how'll I get over to the Midway Air Terminal? And I didn't expect anybody. And I looked up, and here are the Dentlers. So we had some time together. In Detroit, a couple hours before, I'd gotten Bill Fletcher out of bed with a phone call. I said, hello, Bill, this is Lorne. Lorne? I said, yeah, Lorne. Oh, he said, what are you doing here? I said, I'm on my way home. I called the girls home, and I guess they were up already. So we kept our contacts all the way around the world, and then that wonderful time when we got in Denver, and then back down here with all of you. Well, what'll I say? I guess I've said enough already. The main thing that, as I look back on it for myself, for what it's done for my own life, but to realize that we've got a big job to do. There's plenty of room for disciples. There's plenty of room for men and women. Plenty of it. And I am greatly encouraged. And all of these places, and I believe even Pakistan, I really like to go and work myself. You just feel like you'd like to, all right, get enough support for the whole gang, and charter a ship of our own and head on out and take up missionary work. I had hoped to, really, George Sanchez is doing what I'd hoped to do. I'd hoped to get to South America and maybe have the privilege of opening up a country or a nation, continent for the navigators. But I wouldn't mind at all having an assignment in any one of these places. The opportunities are tremendous. The privileges are there. And there are enough Christians in the world to get the job done. We got enough missionaries. It isn't more that we need, it's better. And Hugh, you're going to have a wonderful ministry in Japan. You're going to have to, you can't let any grass grow under your feet, and I know you won't, because we don't know how long we have out there. The Dentlers in Hong Kong, maybe a little scary to mention that the communists could take it in 24 hours. But I don't know how long we'll have out there in that part of the Orient. It may be we'll be transferring all of our Oriental people to Latin America in 5 years. Could be. But we do have an opportunity now. But we need men and women of a certain caliber. Disciples. Now, I'll just remind you of what I mentioned to you last night. There's the world. We're told to go into all the world and preach the gospel to every creature. And the Apostle Paul, as he went around his little world, which was little, of course, compared to ours, he did everything he could to win some. Whatever it took, that he did. And he competed to win. And he exhorted us through the Corinthians to exercise self-control. You can't be used to disciple others unless you're a disciple yourself. We need to be toughened up, all of us, physically, spiritually, mentally, toughened up. We don't live in the real world in America. We live in sort of a make-believe world, really. And I'm sold on America. I could have gotten off the plane and kissed the ground. I was delighted to get home. And it's a great place. When you look at the spiritual needs and what some people are, what it's costing them, well, it just starts with you, and with me. And there's just no limit to what a little one can do. If he's little in his own sight, keeps his hands off the glory, and just seeks to walk with the Lord day by day. Lord, what wilt thou have me to do? An obedient servant. That's what God's looking for. He's not looking for scintillating personalities. We don't need them. We want to improve our speaking ability, but God doesn't need great speakers right now. I said to LaVon, I said, LaVon, I see they're running you to death speaking here and there. That's all right to speak. But you know, we've had good speakers in India for 140 years. Some of them a lot better than you. And it isn't more speakers that India needs. What is it they need? It's disciples, Indians, nationals, dozens, hundreds. So I said, LaVon, judge everything you do on this basis. Does it contribute directly to the training of Indians? And I put it a little strong. I said, LaVon, don't take any speaking date of any kind anywhere in India. Don't attend any conference to speak. Anything but what it relates directly to the training of men, and if it doesn't, don't do it. Wow, it sounds a little rough and a little ruthless. I think we're going to have to get a little ruthless if we're going to stick with the job that God has given us. Because the devil likes to divide and conquer. Spread you out so thin that there's no depth. Of course, when I said this to LaVon, I knew what would happen. It's this. Sure, you can take that speaking date for a conference in the weekend. But if he's going to have to answer, I told him, I said, I may write to you and say, would you please justify what you did on the 13th, the 18th, and the 24th of last month in the light of training men? If I write you a letter like that, I want you to be able to write back and justify your ministry in those days in the light of training men. You know what it'll do? If he accepts a speaking date, he'll stop and think, well, now let's see. How can I utilize that as an opportunity to train somebody? I can take somebody with me. It doesn't mean he won't speak. It means that he'll learn to be increasingly resourceful in using every opportunity, every occasion, to build in somebody's life. That's the kind of a heart we've got to have in navigator personnel. And we aren't going to be very fast in sending people out until we're pretty sure that they've got that down so deep, rock-ribbed, that all the pressures and all the needs and all this and that will not deter them from the main, central, heart, core need. And you may be able to stand up and give a pretty good talk on it, but that doesn't mean that it just captivated your being. That's got to sink down deep. And one reason it takes time, it will take time, is because we want in our work not only people who have the same convictions that we have, but also have our reasons for those convictions. And that takes time and experience. That's why I've seen some in the work, they kind of get off. It almost looks like we lose them. That's all right. Let them get out and see what's going on. Let them tackle something else. Doss used to do that with me. I used to say, well, I know this will work. He said, well, you go ahead then. I told you what our experience has been. You go ahead and give it a try. I'd come back later and say, yeah, I guess you're right. But he let me have the rope, find out for myself. I'd come back with the end of my nose skinned and say, yes, you're right. To build this into a man, and we don't need a large staff, as far as full-time people are concerned, but we need him that's just absolutely rabid on this subject of training man. As to manpower, I should just wind it up with this. In Africa, we don't plan any immediate new moves in Africa. Right now, the need is disciples among the Mau-Mau. We've sharpened the thing up to a real focal point on the Mau-Mau in Africa. You want to pray for Africa? Okay, then we get some disciples in those Mau-Mau. I don't see any point in opening up anything else until we produce the thing that we've been preaching. And oh, Ed and Bob, they just bright-eyed at them. That's what we want. In Europe, we need... I'll tell you what we're thinking. This is a little advance notice. I wasn't going to tell you this exactly. But we want to get a real stem winder for Europe. We want to get the kind of a guy that is just out of his head on the subject of recruiting and building men. We're thinking of Bill Fletcher for England in a year and a half. But I'm just praying about sending over to Europe, or asking at least that the Lord will have us to send someone to Europe who's one of our strongest men in the States, to help the gang over there. They've asked for it. They want it. They need it. One of our strongest men along this line. That's something to pray about. Europe. Of course, we'd like somebody from Panama. We'd like three or four guys more for South Latin America. We'd like to open up three or four more places in the States. Aside from that, we don't have need for too many personnel. We need a few more at the Glen. Man, huh? Any question on anything that I may have left just a little bit dangling or not clear, or something that you think they'd like to hear about that I could just clear up before we close in about 5 minutes? That's a good question. If you're going to be mobile, how can you learn the language? I think I better not start to answer it. It'll take me too long. But we have to do both. So figure that one out. But there are the two extremes. Where I've been told by missions, only come to this country if you're going to give your life here. None of this fly-by-night business. And then the other extreme is just bouncing in for a weekend, you know? So, and it will vary in different countries. That's why I can't give you an answer. I'd have to take you country by country and explain the situation and why it'd be a little different here, a little different there. But we still expect to keep all of our people a little uneasy about how long they're going to be in a given spot. So if you want to settle down to a secure little place for life, you better think twice as to who you come to work with. Because we expect to keep the nest stirred up. Any other question? Okay, let's have a word of prayer.